You are listening to Different Bits, coming at you from the Mission District of San Francisco, streaming on enemycombatantradio.net. My guest tonight is Jamie Schult. He's an engineer who designs systems that engage human aesthetics, culture, and politics. He's been a key collaborator in projects ranging from contestational robotics to video surveillance and interactive installations. He's currently a robotics researcher at Stanford University. He's exhibited work throughout the U.S., as well as internationally, and currently lives in San Francisco. He recently collaborated with Brooke Singer and Beatrice DaCosta on the award-winning project Swipe, an exploration of personal data collection and tracking via driver's license scanning. And I was going to announce our call-in number, and we already have a caller here. So we'll be right back. The number to call, if you'd like to ask questions, is 415-864-1006. And now, Jamie, would you like to say hello?
Hello.
Let's see. And you want to just introduce yourself a little bit, give some background on your work?
Well, I'm Jamie Schulte, and...
Hold on. Your microphone is not on.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Right, I'm Jamie, and you've already said quite a bit about me.
I didn't mean to spoil your self-introduction.
Yeah, I don't know what else to add. I'm an engineer, and work on projects that are of interest mainly to myself, I think, but have been fortunate to collaborate with lots of people.
You know, I'm actually having a little trouble getting a good level from you on the mic,
okay.
So I'm just going to jump back into that musical track and try to fix your mic a little bit. Okay, and now we have our technical problem solved, and you have been listening to a track called In Memoriam of Edgar Varese by Mario Davidovsky, and this was a magnetic tape composition done in the tape studio of the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, done entirely on magnetic tape, with each sound created and controlled entirely by the composer in the tape studio. This is the first track we're going to play this evening from Aspen Issue 4, which Aspen was a multimedia magazine of the arts, originally published in from 1965 to 1971. Each issue of Aspen was delivered to subscribers in a box, which contained a variety of media, printed matter in different formats, phonograph recordings, even a reel of Super 8 film. Aspen was conceived by Phyllis Johnson, but each issue had a new designer and editor. Issue 4 in particular was attempted to take a McLuhan-esque look at our media-made society. And so coming up later, we have a track called Horn by Gordon Mumma. And now, the moment everyone has been waiting for. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Heather.
And Penny is here, too.
Hi.
So why don't you start off? We got a little background on Jamie. He was saying that he was an engineer researching robotics at Stanford.
Right.
And so why don't you tell us about this installation Swipe, which has received so much press?
You said it was award-winning. I didn't even know.
Oh, yeah, it did. It won Experimental Television Award or something.
Oh,
like
right,
that?
yeah, okay. right. Yeah, that piece was motivated by the experience of my collaborators, Brooke Singer and Beatrice DaCosta. They were purchasing a drink, or rather a bottle of wine at a liquor store in Pennsylvania a few years back, and were carded. They're asked for their driver's license, and they complied. One of them complied. And the next thing they saw was the driver's license disappear behind the counter and get swiped through some machine and then returned. And that led to some curiosity about what had just happened and whether there is any, what machine-readable information there was on the ID and what could be done with that information in the future. And that research revealed that Pennsylvania has a sort of preemptive crime-fighting strategy with regard to liquor sales in the state, in that they keep track of who's purchased what, so that, in theory, if someone were to be in a driving accident or to commit a crime, that information would be on file. And in addition to that kind of use, it turns out there are commercial products sold to businesses for swiping driver's licenses at bars. And on the surface, they're described as being used to detect fraudulent IDs by verifying the information on the magnetic stripe or barcode matches that on the face of the license. But it turns out this hardware is bundled with database software, which allows you to essentially get an overview of who your customers are, where they live, when their birth dates are, and any biometric information that might be on the license itself.
And how did you guys learn about this?
Well, you just get on the web and start looking around for references to it. These companies work right out in the open. There's nothing really secret about it. You just have to look around for it.
And so how did this research become the installation that is Swipe? And maybe explain, you know, tell the listeners what Swipe is.
Right. So we were wondering how to make this process of the reuse of the information on a driver's license and potentially other identification more evident to people in the everyday world. And we had gone to the effort to learn about it, and we wanted to see how far that process could go of taking someone's identifying information and reusing it. So we decided that we would start our own bar, and this one would make that process very transparent and explore ways in which it could be pushed further than we believe it currently is. But there's very little to prevent it from going a bit further. So we started a bar, which has one night engagements around the country, behind this beautifully designed bar, we serve drinks. We of course card you just to make sure that you're of legal age. And then with your drink, you receive a receipt which has information that we've pulled from the driver's license, but then that is cross-referenced with data purchased from online data warehouses, such as ChoicePoint, which has been in the news lately.
Yes, it was one of our items on our last show, which was the ECR news also. So what kind of information, like if someone, what might one of these receipts look like?
The receipt would typically start with who you are, basically the information that's on the driver's license. So that's typically biometric information, as well as contact information like your address, which is encoded on a magnetic stripe or 2D barcode. So that will be there, your eye color, hair color, height, weight, depending on the state. And then from there, we add in information like your phone number, your income, whether you have children, the value of your house, organizations that you've contributed to lately, magazines you've subscribed to. Not all this information is available for every person, but it is when there is a match in the database. One aspect of this process is that it's fairly expensive to buy this data, so we usually have limited funds, and someone in our position can't subscribe to a database. That's well beyond our means, so we selectively purchase data for the neighborhoods from which we expect people to be coming from in advance. That comes in that format. And then we combine that with census data, which is used quite a bit for demographic analysis. Mm-hmm. It's a bit less accurate. It's usually accurate to, or it's a conglomeration of data from people within a block or two of where you live. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that will have the number of rooms in your house, commute time. There are tables with literally hundreds of features, so we tend to pick out ones that we find particularly interesting and stick them on there, as well as a map of your neighborhood pointing to where your house is.
That is a little creepy. So what kind of reception have you gotten from your audience members, if you call them that?
It's interesting. There are always some people who see what's going on, and they do not want to have their driver's license swiped. These are typically the converted, in a sense, people who are aware of what we're doing. And but that's actually a very small percentage of people, maybe 3 or 4 in an evening.
Well, I would think, I mean, personally, even if I did know, I would still be really curious what you would dig up.
Yeah, a lot of people are in that position, too. And so they understand that they've got to hand over the information, some information, in order to get it back. And so most people are... they're a little surprised at how much information is out there, is available. Some people find the whole experience just incredibly fun. in a really
well, they are getting drinks after all. I mean, it is kind of fun.
Yeah, and so we hope it will be fun. And clearly, many people are a bit disturbed. Sometimes they're disturbed because the information isn't completely accurate about them, which is another element to this whole situation, which is that there are massive databases of information collected about people, and that information isn't necessarily very accurate or up to date. And to companies that we, that you as a credit card holder or someone trying to get a mortgage or maybe someone looking for a job, that picture of you, that image in the databases is what they see first and is probably going to be the most persuasive thing to them. And so that's another element to the situation that upsets people quite a bit.
And so what is Swipe Toolkit?
Well, we wanted to... The bar was very heavy and hard to move around, and it cost a lot of money to put on these performances, to buy this data and booze, and we wanted to have an online presence that would explore some of the same issues. And we obviously couldn't take submissions from anyone. We couldn't have anyone type in their name and address and pull up this sort of information. That would be too costly. So we looked at other ways of getting at some of that. Some of three things, essentially. What information is actually on your driver's license? What information exists about you out there among the commercial data warehouses such as ChoicePoint? And then how much is that information actually worth? Because the fact that there is this market of data about people that gets passed around, I mean, literally among dozens of companies, they sell this information to each other. You subscribe to a magazine, and my guess is that they then sell information about you, at least that you subscribe to the magazine, upstream to warehouses that then collect and redistribute that information. So the third element to the website is a data calculator that lets you look at the monetary value of different bits of data about a person.
So what concerns you about data collection and tracking?
Well, I guess I've hinted at a bit of it already, but to me, and to the three of us that have worked on Swipe, the biggest concern is that what exists in these databases is an image that is not particularly an accurate image of a person, and which will be used essentially as a social sorting mechanism. So what that means is that two people attempting to get a job, looking for a mortgage or a loan, or a credit card, will be seen not as the people that they are, but as this collection of data that's distributed among data warehouses. And that creates this high-tech means of potential discrimination, which is kind of troubling because you end up with people who are going to look bad in many ways from this perspective. And it's going to be very hard to move outside of that particular domain.
Seems to be a phone call. Oh, it's just not for us. And it was another enemy combatant combatant radio resident who was taking that phone call. Hopefully he'll return the phone in case any of you would like to call in. And I should just say the phone number again is 415-864-1006. And when Mark gets off the phone, you will be free to call in and talk to Jamie.
Right.
We're a poor nonprofit, so we only have one phone, unfortunately.
So just to summarize what I was getting at there is that this kind of data collection facilitates a kind of social sorting mechanism, which brings back the kinds of inequalities that I think many of us are proud in our culture to have tried to put behind us, and it gives it. It just gives it a new form, made possible by a new technology, mm-hmm. and we want to stress that the time is upon us where this is really something to be concerned about.
I was going to say it seems almost like we're heading towards what happens in the movie Brazil, where the characters ends up dead actually because they have the name slightly wrong and they have all this information on this person that they're looking for that's inaccurate, and then it causes the consequences to occur.
Right. I mean, there have been warnings about this, like many other...
For hundreds of years.
Right. It's like science fiction coming to be, basically.
Yeah.
Daily. Yes. And on that note, actually, I was wondering if you could give us a sense of the history behind data collection and sort of how you've seen it evolving over the years. I know I was trying to think myself, you know, what some of the earliest forms of this kind of data collection would be. Obviously the census would be one, but sort of in corporate hands.
Right. That's an interesting question. As a side note to that, the government is actually restricted from collecting just this sort of information in a way that it can be used by, for example, law enforcement. Census data is collected, but that's very carefully compartmentalized from other government agencies. And when it's published in aggregate, mm-hmm. Such as this block-level data I was talking about earlier.
So there is still a sense of anonymity.
In theory, but here's the thing is that ChoicePoint's main customers are government agencies, like the FBI, which essentially use this as a loophole. They can't themselves collect and store information about people, but they have essentially the same. They get the same thing through the free market. It's it's either a beautiful victory for the free market or a kind of horrific end result of it, depending on your perspective. But as far as the history of data collection goes, that's a good question. I haven't looked into that very much. It's certainly accelerated, and there's been money behind that with the passing of the Patriot Act, for example, which expands the number of people that would likely be investigated. As far as information about people being sold, that goes back fairly far. There's an example of an ice cream company. I don't know. This would be several decades ago. This is one of the earliest cited examples of this type of information sharing. There's an ice cream company that I believe it might have been Isley's. I hate to get that wrong, but it collected the names and birth dates of children that frequented the ice cream stores, and it collected this fairly extensive database of names and birth dates, and ended up selling that to the government to issue draft notices when those children turned 17, I guess. So that in a way set a certain precedent, and this is decades ago, but it was probably not the first time something like that has happened, and was probably not an isolated incident even then.
And I guess I'm thinking that because ChoicePoint in particular has been such a big news item recently, do you have any thoughts on that particular company and sort of the scandals and...
It's funny. I haven't followed that as closely as one might think I would. One thing I've noticed, though, is that they issued a statement very early. Well, Actually, apparently they sat on it for a while, and
apparently they did.
And the CEO sold a bunch of stock, and right. and then they issued a very aggressive direct statement, which said that the people who had bought this data and were using it for identity theft were criminals, and that I think there was a quote that they were using the mouse instead of a gun or something to commit this robbery, and. What the effect of that was, I think, was that it put it in these very plain black and white terms, which draw all the attention to the criminal element of having purchased this data for the purpose of identity theft, when in a lot of ways it seems like the real news story here is that there's this company, ChoicePoint, and they have all this information about us, and they'll sell it to anyone. And so I haven't seen that story run anywhere.
I know. I mean, what is the difference between, these alleged criminals having your information and anyone else?
The government.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the criminals will, apply for credit cards in your name, and there are some differences there, but you have to ask, once the data is out of your control,
But how does ChoicePoint know that anyone else who buys their data, wouldn't do that?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And one thing I'd like to look at, if no one else does soon, is to look at, to try to get a sense of who their customers are and just how much of a difference there is between the fake companies that were set up to purchase this data and so-called legitimate companies that purchase this data and whether they're a legitimate company, so-called legitimate companies, purchasing the same sorts of data and why. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be a very interesting thing to look at.
Would it be difficult to get a hold of your own data if we didn't know about you and going through your channels, just to see if it's accurate or what's out there?
So in terms of credit information, I think this is just credit information, but there is a program in place right now that lets you get a free credit report once a year, mm-hmm. and the idea is that through that you can see if anyone has, you can kind of get a sense for who's been looking at your credit record and see if there's anything on it that doesn't pertain to you, that would be a sign of identity theft. One of the features on the Swipe Toolkit website is a set of forms that you can send to different companies. It costs from, I think, $10 to $25, something in that range, for each company to do it. But you can get a full report of data that they have about you, and that will essentially be a list of phone numbers that you've had for the last few years, addresses, credit report information, cars and property that you may have owned. Probably if I did more business transactions, there would have been more about me on my own. But it's interesting because it's from each of these companies that are listed on the Swipe Toolkit website. You'll get five.
And what
or
was
10
that
pages.
Website again?
What is that website? Probably the easiest way to do it is to go to www.we-swipe.us. From there, there should be a Swipe Toolkit link. It's hosted by the Turbulence Organization, which funded that project.
Great. And you guys are traveling around doing workshops and stuff on the subject, right?
We're doing workshops in an effort to explain and demystify RFID, radio frequency identification technology. So that is one of our current efforts, is to just explore that medium, which has received a lot of press, much of it technically not very well informed, so that people can understand that better. And as part of the workshop, people can build their own RFID reader detector, which is a device that will tell you if there's anything that could potentially read any RFID tags that are on you or in the area nearby. So
since this has come up, actually, do you want to just explain to the listeners who don't know what RFID is exactly?
Right. Yeah. So RFID is it's a buzzword. It's a somewhat new technology that is actually a lot like a barcode on, you know, any product you buy. The difference between RFID and a barcode is that a RFID tag, as it's called, is read wirelessly by a device that emits radio waves in proximity to it. And it can hold a fair amount of information and actually can uniquely identify a particular product. So whereas a barcode on a bottle of water might indicate that it's a 16-ounce bottle of water, a RFID tag on the same thing would indicate that it's a 16-ounce bottle of water, and its serial number, its unique identification is, you know, some 96-bit string, which essentially creates a situation in which, in theory, a device could be invisibly tracked as it moves through space, through cities, all over the place, and that there's a huge interest in this from the perspective of the people who make things and sell them to you, because many of the people who are employed in that industry are simply there to make sure that the bottles of water are being manufactured at the right rate, that they're going out to the right places, that when Walmart needs new water, they're shipped there quickly. And with RFID, this information is always present in the system. It's as though typically you'd have a person doing inventory periodically, updating tables in a database, indicating how much water is distributed where. And with RFID, it's almost as though the database moves out of the computer and it's there in the warehouse or the truck. And essentially, it creates this automatic... The goal that is being sought is one in which you could essentially have a computer system run the logistics of a company, and what the advantage of that to a large degree is you can, as a company, react more quickly to real world events and not have to pay that portion of the staff because they're now gone. Mm-hmm.
And the RFID tags can also be updated as well, correct? So you could potentially have this bottle of water, which also then knows who purchases it.
Potentially, yeah. That potential is there. Not all tags can be updated. The ones that can are usually a bit more expensive. Walmart.
So maybe not a bottle of water, but a car or.
Yeah, or a large. Crate of water, for example. So Walmart has recently started tagging most inventory with these tags. They won't be on anything you buy from Walmart in most cases because they're on the essentially at the crate and pallet level, as it's called. So this is large packages of stuff. And that packaging usually doesn't make it out of the store, though they've begun trials in around Dallas-Fort Worth at a number of Walmarts where everything, at least in certain product categories, is tagged. Mm-hmm. And so it's on the bottle of water when you take it out of the store. That makes the cashierless checkout, the self-checkout, much easier in theory, mm-hmm. too. And then, right, it's in your house, and people, the RFID visionaries, researchers around the world and business people have this idea that the tags can then have use in your house. Your refrigerator will know, exactly what's in it, expiration dates for, things other than water that might expire. It could be internet-enabled and purchase more products for you as soon as you are in danger of running low of your old ones. It's this very Jetsons-like scenario, which has been dangled in front of us forever and is slowly coming to be. It's interesting how much, it sounds ridiculous, but I think that this is one way that the negative press that RFID has been getting will perhaps be eroded if there are problems in the future, in the sense that you'll want to buy the RFID tagged milk because you'll never be in danger of accidentally drinking slightly soured milk in the future, because your refrigerator will warn you that the milk is sour before you have a chance to make that error. And you know, you can get discounted milk from some company that sponsored the initiative, and have it delivered to your door automatically without you having done anything.
I don't think we're really going to be offered an option about whether we want to buy items with RFID tags or not. First of all, because they are radio frequency tags instead of visible tags like a barcode, you won't necessarily even see it that it's there.
Yeah, that's a concern that many people have, and at least with the current technology, it would be hard not to see such a tag. It's actually powered by the radio signal that hits it, and that's really important because it means that the tag doesn't need a battery, so it can be smaller and cheaper than it would otherwise be. But it also means that it will essentially work indefinitely. It has no off switch, but that does make it somewhat larger, at least in two dimensions, because it has an antenna, which is typically a spiral.
Right. So in a bottle of water, yeah, but in, you know, an item of electronics or
right,
most consumer goods that we have in our house are not
right
as transparent as bottles of water.
That's true. I mean, it's possible that it could be hidden in some devices. Right. I mean, you can ask why would anyone want to hide an RFID tag in anything you own? And my guess is there will be no hiding of it. It'll be incentivized. I mean, you will be told that you want the RFID enabled cassette deck or something, because the repair people can just scan it when you bring it in for repair and repair it, you know, much more easily. Mm-hmm. And then they may require that you have an RFID enabled device. Otherwise, they don't want to deal with it. That's one way that things tend to progress.
Would there be a way, though, to see that if it was even giving you accountable information down the line, like when it's telling you if your milk is soured, if it's really soured, or if it's just saying that because they want you to buy more milk?
No, I mean you just have to use common sense, I guess. But there's nothing.
In other situations where, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the tags, they're really just, they just hold some information. There are ones that can detect temperature, air pressure, that sort of thing for cargo that needs to stay cold, for example. But anything on your milk, it would just be linked by some, there'd be some expiration date essentially stored in the tag's memory.
Well, hopefully you would still get a printed expiration date as well.
<We'd hope. laughs>
They're not too difficult to figure out. So just to sort of shift gears now, could you talk a little bit about Moport?
Yeah. Moport is another project by this mini collective with Beatrice DaCosta and Brooke Singer. It was really initially just an experiment to see if we could combine the sort of collective power of all the camera cell phones that people have in an event like a street protest, such as the Republican National Committee convention in New York in August. And for anyone who's been at a protest that has not gone well, you see police doing things, for example, and you wonder how they can get away with that, and where are the people documenting this? And often enough, there are people documenting it, and it doesn't matter. But we wanted to create a situation in which everyone with a cell phone camera could contribute to the real-time, very bottom-up collective documentation of the event, to get as many images from as many points of view all on the same page as possible, and then to try to organize that information in a way that one could sort through it and get some sense of what was going on that would be different than other media sources, much as indie media does very successfully as well.
So how did it go?
It went quite well. We got hundreds of submissions. We just put a small amount of effort, as much effort as we could, given that we're trying to develop this in parallel. But we just went out there and distributed small leaflets explaining how to submit an image to the Moport website. And
how does one do that?
So currently we do that by email. So that limits it to phones that can send an image, send an email with an image attachment to a particular address. When that image is sent by email, it goes directly to the web page. Then in the future, we hope to improve it so that it can make use of, I believe it's a multimedia. There's a improvement over SMS. I think it's MMS, which allows you to essentially send an SMS message that has an image attachment. So using that, I think it'd be open to a larger number of people.
Mm-hmm. Are there any events planned right now where you're going to utilize this?
March 17th.
Yeah, we're always open to suggestions. We're kind of in a retooling phase right now, and trying to find a way to make it to get more people involved and to do it in such a way that people without cell phones could potentially do it, or without some of the newer picture and email capable cell phones. It also works with a digital camera. I mean, you can just send an image attachment from your email account. But yeah, the site is www.moport.org, and we'd love to hear suggestions on events. We might be slower to react right now, given that we're doing some retooling of the website, but we have nothing planned right now.
Well, keep an eye on the Indie Media Events calendar. It's always a good place to find events for.
We've been talking to Indie Media New York City about that a bit, and we're hoping there's some way that we can leverage the infrastructure that Indie Media has in place already, and rather than be another competitive news source, to try to find a way that we can kind of assist in that effort.
Combine forces. There's definitely always room. I mean, it would be great for the March 19th anti-occupation, massive demonstrations planned around the world on March 19th for anyone who is not aware. So on the subject, you mentioned briefly, you can use a digital camera instead. And also thinking about indie media, one of the primary concerns and something we try to address here in indie media is accessibility and how to, there's a lot of sort of new technology-based open media platforms, and they all rely on technology that are only accessible to, really a small portion of the population. Mm-hmm. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I share that frustration. It makes me reluctant to develop for anything that I do that I want people to use on platforms, no matter how exciting and wonderful they may be. If it's only reaching people who are serious enthusiasts of that particular technology or have money to burn, then it's... any project that is meant to be in open publishing or speech enabling technology, if it excludes most people, then that gets a lot less interesting.
Well, it's sort of this underlying contradiction too, just in the whole sort of concept of activist media technology. That concept itself is sort of so self-contained and contradictory.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, there is something to be said for taking this technology when it's new and finding a niche for it early on that would be hard to take away later. I'm trying to think of a good parallel to that. I mean, one could argue that this happened semi-successfully with the internet. That had not so many people found it so worthwhile to spend time communicating with each other over the internet. I think it would be a lot easier now to limit people's access to it. But now it's seen as a basic right to anyone who can afford a network connection. And so attempts to restrict network access have been or rather not to restrict network access, but to restrict people's ability to communicate how they want. They have been actually fairly successful, but
well, freedom and privacy, you know, are sort of
we're not in a
on the decline
time,
and
but there have been more attempts than there have been successes, and so I think there is something to be said for you know, reaching out and grabbing new technologies and trying to make use of that.
Well, and there is, I mean, they do have an effect. There is a positive effect of doing this, and you know, the trade-off is sort of you know, whether giving up ideals of accessibility is worthwhile to strive for something else, like the TextMob project was, mm-hmm. I would say, really surprisingly successful at the RNC, you know, and that's obviously a similar sort of project, dealing with sending text messages over mobile phones, which only people with mobile phones are going to benefit from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was a huge organizational force. And
yeah, and that particular project, I mean, one thing that was nice about it was it targeted one of the most ubiquitous features of mobile phone technology. I mean, it could have required picture phones, for example, which Moport did, that or a digital camera. But almost every phone can at least receive SMS text messages.
Right.
So that... Yeah, given that for example, payphones are on the decline, most people are expected to have, most people do have cell phones, or at least have access to one.
I didn't mean to sort of drive us into a hole here, but dismal. So since we are running a bit low on time now, I did want to talk about your project with Vita and sympathetic sentience, and if you could sort of... maybe switching gears for a third time, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that was that's a project from a number of years ago. That was with the artist Simon Penny, who's been a long time, who I've collaborated with for a long time, and who is one of the key people who introduced me to the field of electronic art.
How did you get to know each other?
He was a professor at Carnegie Mellon, where I was studying as an undergrad at the time, and it's funny, I'm actually drawing a blank on how we actually met. I think I took a class of his, and at some point we were talking about a sound installation that we were talking back and forth about a particular idea for a sound installation. It turned out we had a certain kind of set of ideas in common, and they seemed very doable. And that's where this piece, Sympathetic Sentience, came from. The idea of that piece is to it's hard to hard to reduce to just a few words, but it's a group of unique and very, very simple electronic devices, each of which performs a very simple operation. It listens for any activity of its neighbor. If its neighbor makes any sounds, it waits briefly, repeats that sound, and then passes it on. And the piece is organized so that there are 8 to 20 of these units organized in one or more loops. And so an event that gets into one of these loops will get passed around and around and around. And in addition to listening for what each unit's neighbors are doing and passing it on, each one, every once in a while, every minute or so, will make a contribution or change the tone of a sound or remove a sound altogether from that stream. And so the piece will start with no activity at all, nothing in the loop, and then one sound will get added, and then another, and then another, and over a few minutes, you get this gradual buildup to a very chaotic and yet very organized, repetitive stream of sounds that's slowly modulating and changing.
Do you want to maybe provide just a brief explanation of emergence for the listeners?
Yeah.
Put you on the spot.
That's a. I don't have a one sentence definition of that. I don't know if I've ever seen it.
You can give, you know, 3 or 4 sentences if you like.
Right. So it comes from a number of different contexts. I think one of the earliest contexts from which it arose was in the natural sciences, from observations of the way that colonies of animals, such as insects will, or ants will, display a collective behavior, that's seemingly much more sophisticated than the individual behaviors that the ants are capable of. And, there's been a long history of looking at processes in the natural sciences and even in disciplines such as physics and mathematics from this notion of the emergent result of the synthesis of many independent actors creating a larger both more sophisticated and less, as well as in many ways less complicated behavior from the sum of many individual mm-hmm. Components.
And so how does this connect to artificial life?
Well, I think...
And how is artificial life distinct from artificial intelligence?
All good questions.
They're some of my favorites.
I can understand why. Well, so artificial, that's an interesting series of questions.
You don't have to answer them, of course. If you don't
right,
want
no,
to.
No, I, it brings a lot to mind, actually. Given that I study artificial intelligence, as well, and there's been a long, kind of back and forth tradition, mainly in favor of a sort of hierarchical top-down definition of intelligence, with occasional resistance to that within the community. So to take a step back, many of the proponents of studies and the aesthetics of emergent behavior see natural systems as these collections of small events, small individual actions and behaviors, and the very difficult but fascinating way and difficult to systematize, difficult to rationalize, but fascinating way that they come together and create larger behavior in artificial intelligence, there's a long tradition of having a much more top-down, descriptive approach, which emphasizes the whole order and the intent of an intelligence to accomplish a set of tasks, usually in a fairly
rule-based
pre-planned way. And so there's been this long decades old kind of back and forth, maybe not actually visible to many in the AI community, I don't think so maybe back
prodding.
And forth isn't quite right. Prodding from the community of people who look at emergent behaviors, and it's not like that's all either party thinks about, I don't think, but the AI life community, from what I've seen, is often really interested in the kind of mesmerizing kind of fascinating properties that happen in systems where you see emergent behaviors occurring, and that doesn't fit well with the AI artificial intelligence community's kind of rational planning oriented way of doing things. I mean, of course, we're looking at one side at life, or emulating life artificially, lifelike processes, essentially by kind of repeating many different or simulating lots of small events, as opposed to thinking about thinking in AI, where you're trying to typically model human or human-like thought, or as is more often the case, simply perform similar actions or similar behaviors to those that a human or human-like intelligence might engage in, without a whole lot of concern necessarily for how close that matches how people actually think.
So intelligence, perhaps as an emergent property of a system, as opposed to what? What would you say if you can sort of pigeonhole AI into one box, intelligence would be?
Yeah, that's hard to do, because there have been many approaches over the years to trying to do what AI does, which is to nail down intelligence.
So the biggest, what would you say the biggest AI attempts are right now?
Right,
big database driven.
Right now, there is a lot of interest in, again, AI is too big of a field to describe all of it. Mm-hmm. Shoots out in different directions, and communities persist and continue to do certain things for long periods of time. So it would really, someone who works in this field and around this field, I'd be uncomfortable, because every time I try to think of a particular sort of definition of what the current state of the art is, I think of someone who doesn't fit into that category.
So we'll maybe just talk about what you're working on.
Right.
If you can, let's close this.
Yeah. So I work in a group at Stanford that essentially specializes in using probabilistic methods for robots to determine where they are and what sort of environment that they're in. And by probabilistic methods, I mean that the robot never... It's actually an attempt to get away from this kind of very strict, very deterministic notion in which a robot always assumes it knows exactly where it is, what it needs to do next to accomplish its larger goals. So while it doesn't get away entirely from that kind of planning approach, which is pretty much endemic in AI, it does open itself up to the possibility that you don't know exactly where you are, what you need to do next to accomplish your task. Mm. And considers multiple possibilities and uses, for the most part, just goes out and borrows tools that were derived in statistics over the last few centuries to try to figure out, okay, well, I don't know, but here's the information that I have. Mm-hmm. Here are the results of things that I've tried before. What makes the most sense now, mm-hmm. given that situation? So that's this probabilistic robotic navigation and planning.
And do you still work with sort of emergent ideas at all, artificial life kind of stuff? Does that still enter your thoughts or not so much?
It very much enters my thoughts. It's very much in my thoughts. I'd be very interested in looking at that more. I've been reading a bit... been reading a bit of work by a former AI researcher named Philip Agre. He's received his PhD, I think, in the late 80s from the MIT AI lab. Mm-hmm. And he fought this constant battle, from what I've seen, with the AI community, mm-hmm. pushing for... actually an old idea, a more behavior-based notion of what intelligence is, which has a lot of ties to the work that people do that are interested in A-life and emergent behavior and systems. And it's quite inspiring to me, kind of how he talks about what he feels is wrong in the current field of artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. or of a decade ago anyway.
So explain what you mean by behavior-based.
So it's interesting. There's been a co-evolution of psychology and and computer science since essentially World War II, as many people describe it. This is what I understand about this is based on readings, of course. I wasn't alive then. there's a narrative which I've heard and read in a number of places, which is that in the early part of this century, behaviorism, which is a particular mode of doing psychology, was largely in favor. It's kind of bleak in its way of describing human behavior, but it describes certain things fairly well. World War II happened, and a lot of researchers from the psychology field were put to work helping. To essentially organize the logistics of the war. Many of them returned and became key scientists in academia and were supposedly very influenced by that experience. And the experience was one which involved essentially trying to rationalize economic production, organization and division of labor within the military. And at the same time, the field of cybernetics was being born by, for example, Norbert Wiener, who coined the term and helped design anti-aircraft systems, guns, which could, to some extent, predict where the plane would be in the future just based on its trajectory. Something a person would normally do, but a very simple analog circuit, it turns out, could do the same job a lot faster and more accurately. And that the mix of all these things created a lot of excitement that maybe we can make mechanical electronic systems which can duplicate human behavior, and perhaps human behavior can be described by these sorts of systems. And so from that, as my basic, very basic understanding goes, the field of cognitive psychology was born, which attempts to do that from the psychology end of things. And the field of AI also was, to some extent, born or thrown in that direction. The computers were now on the scene. Computers, yeah, which had been largely developed as part of the war, and now we're open to new uses. And it's really interesting. I mean, one of the first projects that the early computer scientists wanted to engage in was emulating human intelligence. Mm-hmm. And again, the lessons of the war were that maybe this was possible. No one knew how to do it at the time, but
do you think we know how to do it now?
We have no clue how to do it now.
Maybe we're more clued into our cluelessness now.
Yeah, there's not a lot of effort right now to do that, actually. Again, within
money.
The community that I'm a part of, there actually are efforts. Many of them really reaching back to those days, in fact, that actually use somewhat emergent properties of kind of essentially a collection of behaviors. The proposition is that people's brains are a collection of very simple behaviors. They all coexist. And in response to different stimuli, certain ones dominate at certain times. And that, in both AI and robotics, that idea has surfaced and resurfaced mm-hmm. periodically. And there are people who continue to do that sort of work now.
I wish we had more time to continue this conversation, but we don't. So I guess I would like to close by just asking you if you have any plans for the future that you'd like to share with our audience.
I'm working hard on a number of things. We are hoping to extend Moport and make it more usable to more people. If we can get funding, be actually buying cell phones for people and finding situations in which they can be used.
Let me know where those situations are taking place.
I will
I wouldn't
mind
a camera phone.
Well, they would be lent to people. if we can get funding. This is all very contingent on many things. The Zapped project, that's the RFID work that I've been contributing to, we will be working on a number of ways of directly confronting Walmart's adoption of this technology and looking at different ways to throw a monkey wrench into that system or enable people to do that and just let people understand that technology a mm-hmm. bit better.
Yeah, those workshops sound like great ideas.
Right. Yeah. So we're pushing ahead on that, trying in particular to address school children that have been RFID tagged. It's interesting to see the progression of this technology. I mean, to see where it gets attached to living things first. I mean, the initial, so far we have pets. You can inject a chip under your pet's skin so it can be identified quickly. Prisoners in many prisons, or several, at least several prisons, have been RFID tagged. Corpses are now
optionally
being...
Optionally or...?
No, not optionally. Are you kidding? It's a prison.
Right. No, I hadn't heard too much about that. I'm surprised I haven't heard more about that.
Yeah, I believe it isn't widespread at the moment, or I haven't heard that it is, but
that's
there... as of over a year ago, I was reading a story about a prison in Arizona, possibly Phoenix, that was doing this. People in hospitals, particularly Alzheimer's patients, are being tagged. And now more recently school children in the Houston area. And there was this, Sutter, a school in Sutter, California, near Sacramento, which, actually had its parents and students reject the system, but they did have a RFID tagging system in place for some time. So it's kind of interesting to see which parts of our population and pets become susceptible first, and it's interesting to see how just the progression of that. That's one thing that we hope to illustrate.
Any predictions on what's next? Goldfish.
Right. I think there will be a lot more tagging of children in the future, would be my guess, because, you know, it's for their safety. Mm-hmm. We're all concerned about our children, and we'll do whatever it takes to protect our children, to protect ourselves from terrorism. And RFID tagging, in theory, might do that. I don't actually agree with that statement, but that's typically the way that this kind of thing is argued.
Right?
Yeah. In practice, it saves school districts money, possibly, and provides some assurance to parents.
And potentially provides a whole lot of information for other people who would like to gain that information.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jamie.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. And now we will jump to that track I was speaking about earlier, Horn. And I will say good night and join me next week for different bits.